Welcome to the Lizzie Borden Podcast, Episode 27. I am your host, Stephanie Corey, filling in for the late Richard Behrens, author of the Lizzie Borden Girl Detective series of mysteries. The Lizzie Borden Podcast is the only podcast entirely devoted to the study of the Borden murders of 1892, Lizzie Borden, and sometimes the history of her hometown, Fall River, Massachusetts. Produced by Nine Muses Books and Anna Behrens. Each episode explores some aspect of the mystery that is Lizzie Borden, from the origins of the doggerel, Lizzie Borden Took an Axe, to a primer on the case by noted authors and experts, including dramatic readings of Richard Behrens' Lizzie Borden Girl Detective mystery series. In this episode, we interview Bill Spencer, author of the new book, The Other Fall River Tragedy, The Murder of Bertha Manchester, out now on Amazon in hard copy and Kindle, as well as the online store for the Fall River Historical Society. Bertha Manchester was murdered by multiple blows with an axe in her home in Fall River in the north part of the city on Memorial Day, 1893, almost exactly 9 months after the Borden murders and 1 week before the jury was chosen and sequestered for the Lizzie Borden trial. Did the knowledge of this crime affect the verdict in Lizzie's case? Let's investigate. And now, the Lizzie Borden Podcast presents an interview with Bill Spencer. Today on the Lizzie Borden Podcast, we have William D. Spencer. Listeners from previous podcasts might remember Bill. People will remember Bill from the podcast when he talked about his book, Lizzie Borden, A Casebook of Theories. But he's also the author of The Case Against Lizzie Borden, which was his first book on the case. But today, we are talking with Bill about his newest book. It is about a case that no one has written about before, called The Other Fall River Tragedy, The Murder of Bertha Manchester, which is out now on Amazon, in paperback, and on Kindle. Welcome, Bill.
Thanks for having me, Stephanie.
We know you from your previous two books, and we now know that you've written the Bertha Manchester book, which is kind of what it's euphemistically called. So what made you interested in Bertha after studying Lizzie? And why should we be interested in this case also?
Well, pretty much everyone knows about Lizzie Borden, and those murders occurred in August of 1892. And her trial didn't start until the following June. Less than a week ahead of the trial, a woman named Bertha Manchester was killed in Fall River, and it turns out she was hacked to death with an axe. Of course, much of Fall River and other areas supported Lizzie Borden, and since the second murder happened in a similar circumstance, and that is that the victim was hacked to death, they turned to this case and said, well, perhaps there's an axe murder still around in Fall River, and that's the person that killed the Bordens. So the Bertha Manchester murder got a lot of press at the time.
Well, that's interesting. Does that mean that it was covered by some of the same reporters that was covering the Lizzie Borden case?
Interestingly enough, it was reported in the Los Angeles Times. That's how much press it got. It only got a few lines. But the reason was because, and the Borden case starts next week, you know, is what the newspaper said. Yes, the same, pretty much, as far as I could tell, pretty much the same reporters covered both cases. There were three major newspapers in Fall River, and of course, all three of them covered this.
Isn't it amazing that Fall River had three newspapers at one time?
Well, all the cities had a lot of newspapers then.
Yeah.
In fact, Fall River had a fourth newspaper for a while just before that.
The Monitor.
Right.
It's funny because I was looking up some research, and when I was doing some work for the Historical Society, and the early Fall River Daily Evening News, the whole front page of the newspaper's advertising, all of it just starts off with that. So it was mainly an advertising vehicle, and maybe some news was in it until it became mostly news and less advertising.
Oh, so, yeah, just to add on to that response as well, the murder occurred on Memorial Day, which is a Tuesday, and the Borden trial started the following Monday. There was an arrest made, but not until early Sunday morning, like 3 o'clock in the morning, 4 o'clock in the morning, something like that. The person that was arrested was arraigned on Monday morning at the same time the Lizzie Borden trial started. So the jurors were picked that day and they were sequestered. So most likely, they probably knew about the Manchester murders, although it was in New Bedford where the trial was. They probably knew about the Manchester murders, but they almost certainly didn't know somebody was arrested before they went to deliberate on the Lizzie Borden case.
I think that's quite significant. And I think we're going to get to that in a little bit. And I right. think that that's something that people haven't really paid attention to as a side issue with the jury's deliberations. In this book, which I really like, you have a couple of gems. You have this photograph of Stephen Manchester that nobody has ever seen before, who is the father of Bertha Manchester. You have a page from Bertha's homework, which really surprised me. And how did you get these particular items to put in your book?
So if you look at the Borden family, they were pretty famous and you can find some things about them. The Manchester family wasn't. So in looking at this case, I really didn't have much to go on for background. So I said, well, I've got nothing to lose. I'm a member of Ancestry.com. And I went and put Stephen Manchester's vitals in there and about 40 family trees came up. Some of the trees are public, some aren't. And I contacted all 40 of those people. And it was a crapshoot. I didn't think much would happen. I probably got, I don't know, 6 or 7 responses. Most people responded, said that the family never talked about it. Every family seems to have something like that. And this family didn't talk about it. One of the people that responded said he was the great-grandson of Stephen Manchester's oldest son, but he didn't know anything about the case. Because he said his grandfather was distant from the family, which the newspapers of the time said he was. So this ancestor confirmed it. And so there was nothing that passed down to him about Bertha. The person that did come through, though, was able to send me the one picture of Stephen. And if you look at it, I didn't use it in the book, but there's a newspaper etching or sketch, however they did at the time. That's that exact picture. But I was able to get the actual photograph. And somehow he had the homework assignment. I couldn't tell if the homework assignment or a test, but he had that. And I was amazed. If you read the case, you think, oh, this poor farm girl, she could barely read. And if you read the homework assignment, her handwriting is perfect. Her grammar is very good. She was a pretty intelligent girl.
Did he have anything else but those two things?
That's the only two things he had. He said he was going to look for some other things, and I prodded him on it, but he never either couldn't find them or didn't do it.
Wow.
His grandmother was Bertha's niece. So I think that would mean Stephen Manchester's brother or sister's offspring.
Okay.
Was his grandmother.
Well, that was very ingenious of you to go after family tree builders. I've gone on to Ancestry and tried to contact people to give things away, and I never get anybody to reply. I don't think people realize that there's a messaging feature on.
Yeah, there's a messaging feature, so that's what I use. And of course, I have to say, if I got something like that, I might be skeptical. You know, here's a guy that's trying to scam me or whatever.
Right.
I said who I was, and I wrote these other books, and I'm trying to get this. So I don't know if that happened at all, but at least I was able to get some feedback.
That's fabulous. That's really great. In addition to Ancestry and getting a hold of a real-life person who had some material, what's the research like when you have a case that never went to trial? This one never went to trial, so you don't have a trial transcript. How'd you handle the legal aspects of the case in writing about this story?
So it's interesting. In the Borden case, as you well know, you have all kinds of primary source material. You have the witness statements, you have the inquest testimony, preliminary hearing testimony, and the trial testimony, which is where I got almost everything as far as background material for the Borden books. In this case, none of those things existed. Or if they existed, they're long gone. The police did, according to the newspapers, the police did go around and talk to people, which makes sense. But the Manchesters lived way out in they're in the city, but they're at the very end of the city. And it looks like the middle of Iowa. I mean, it's very desolate and rural at the time. You know, the streets are dirt roads. Everything's a farm. So the police went around, but there was only one person that heard anything, and that was the daughter of the farm owner. I'll say across the street. Probably wasn't exactly across the street in those days. And she heard the dogs bark in the morning, but the Manchesters had two dogs that barked at everything. So this girl, a young woman she was attuned to ignore the dogs. So she completely ignored the dogs barking. And she didn't even think about it until the police came by and asked her. That's the only thing I could find that from the police as far as them asking anything. There was no inquest, and I don't know who they would have had testify at the inquest, because if you go back to the Borden inquest, it's people that came to the house afterwards, the servant and so on. Nobody was in the house when Bertha Manchester was murdered. So, and as I said, no one in the neighborhood had heard anything. So I'm not sure what an inquest would have solved anyway. There was a preliminary hearing, and it only was basically one witness, which was Stephen Manchester. And after he testified, the defense threw in the towel and said they gave up and the case was scheduled for trial. So, and even that wasn't the original testimony. I found that by putting the three newspaper results together to get the testimony of the preliminary hearing. And the Borden case was so overwhelming, and I'm not sure the legality of this, but of course the district attorney questioned the witnesses for the prosecution in the Borden case. In the Manchester preliminary hearing, the judge asked the questions for the prosecution. So I was stuck as far as getting any material that way. So I turned to the newspapers, and I was very reluctant to do so because, as you know, the newspapers just butchered the Borden case. If you read the three newspapers, you get three different stories on the Borden case. For whatever reason, that wasn't true in the Manchester case. The newspapers almost always agreed on everything, and it seemed all believable. So the book is based on newspaper records, but I feel confident that it's pretty accurate.
You know, it's funny. I don't think we've actually informed our listeners about the Manchester murder. So Tell us about when it happened, what happened, and just general synopsis of what we're talking about When we talk about Bertha Manchester's murder.
So Stephen Manchester, the Manchester family dates back in Fall River, the 1600s. Stephen Manchester, who was the father of Bertha, he was born in 1829 or 30. It's murky about which year it was. I think it was 1829. Put in perspective, Andrew Borden was born in 1822. So he was just a little younger than Andrew Borden. In 1849, he became a whaler. And the other thing I was able to check, which are pretty good records of, is the Whaling Museum in New Bedford has a website. I believe it's their website, but there's a whaling website. And it has a ton of records of the early whaling days. And I was able to find some information about him, which ships he was on and so on. In the early 1860s, you come to a problem because the whaling records indicate Stephen Manchester still on a whaling ship. But the Fall River records say he gets married in Fall River in 1864, which clearly has to be true or they wouldn't have had the record in Fall River. So at least for 10 years or so, he was on a whaling ship or whaling ships. He came back to Fall River. He got married in 1864. He bought the farm on New Boston Road in 1867 and built it up. Much like Andrew Borden, who started with very little, he started with very little. And he built it up and bought cows, and he became mainly a dairy farmer, but he also bought land. So he also sold crops. So as a dairy farmer, every day he had to milk the cows, or someone had to milk the cows, and then he had to deliver the milk in his roof. He had four children in his first marriage, and the oldest one was Harry. That's the one that I mentioned was separated from the family. Once he became older, early adulthood, he left. Then he had a daughter named Jenny in 1868. Bertha in 1871, and 10 years later, a son, Freddie. Freddie was born in December of 1881, and in January of 1882, Stephen's wife died, apparently from complications of the childbirth. At first, Jenny took over running the household, but then she got married to a man named W.W. Coolidge, and she moved out. Stephen's sister helped out for a while, but basically it came down to Bertha to run the house. Then Stephen got married in 1884 to a woman named Mary Jane Whittles, and they had a son in 1885. However, the marriage went sour really quick, and Mary Jane moved out, lived there for a while, moved out, came back a couple of times, but basically the marriage never amounted to much.
She took the baby with her when she left.
And she took the baby with her. And in fact, it was some interview, and I don't know where I read it, but it was a legal interview. And I think it was the mayor or somebody, or the police chief, was speaking to the other members of the Manchester family. And I think it was Jenny said that they never paid, they never even considered the youngest son, whose name is Alexander, to be a family member.
The marriage was so right. not important to him because it was so short.
Right.
Right. So then he's off doing his normal thing, but it's decoration day, right? It's
well, before, let me take a step before that. He's got a dairy farmer. I forgot. I think he had something like 30 cows. I forgot the number. It was a lot of cows. Might have been 20. So his oldest son, you know, in typical farm family, the oldest son would have taken over the farm, but the son wasn't interested. He's gone. The next oldest one, the daughter, she's gone. So all he's got is Bertha. So Bertha is running the house. Now they have no electricity, no running water, and so on. And they have horses. Someone has to take care of the cooking, the cleaning, feeding the horses, and all that. So Stephen is relegated to hiring hired help. A lot of the hired help is foreign-born because at that time, Fall River had immigrant after immigrant coming in. A lot of them worked the mills, but a lot of them worked the other jobs that were available. In October of 1892, an immigrant showed up at the farm, couldn't speak English, somehow communicated that he wanted a job. Stephen asked him somehow if he could milk a cow. The person went and milked the cow, did quite well, so Stephen hired him. And in those days, the hired help stayed in it was room and board. You got paid room and board. So the person stayed overnight. Next morning, he left, got up and left. He came back in May, middle of May, and did the same thing. Came back one more time, and the third time, he would go along with them on the milk run. And this third time, it was either the second or third time, they ran into some Azorian nationals on the sidewalk in Fall River, and one of them spoke English, and they told Stephen he wasn't paying the worker enough money. The worker's name was Jose Carrero, although Stephen called him Manuel because he didn't pay any attention to real names. I guess because people came and went so much, and he didn't want to figure out the foreign names. Stephen wouldn't pay him any more money, so Jose got off the cart, milk cart, and didn't come back. That was the second time. The third time, they happened to run into him on the sidewalk, and Freddie, the son who was with Stephen at the time, convinced Stephen to ask him to come back, Jose to come back one more time. And Jose agreed. And again, he works a day and leaves. So now we're up to Memorial Day. And by now, a different worker named John Tunsell, who's about 18, I believe, is working with Stephen. And the three men, Stephen, Freddie, who's actually a boy, and John Tunsell, leave that morning to deliver the milk. Now, it's a holiday. It's a federal holiday, but they were dairy farmers. You know, you got to milk the cows. You got to deliver the milk. They invite Bertha to come with them, but she says she can't do it because she's got so much work. And in fact, the woman that I mentioned that heard the dogs, when the police interviewed her, I guess she was pretty much Bertha's only friend at the time. And she said Bertha was always so overwhelmed with work that she didn't go to church, didn't have a boyfriend, didn't do anything except work all the time. So Bertha stayed home by herself. Interestingly enough, during the milk run in Fall River, the three people on the milk wagon see Jose Carrero at what's called the Crab Pond Bridge, which is on the river. And he waves to them and they nod to him. They finish the milk run and get home about 2:30. And Freddie gets off the cart, runs in the house. Stephen takes the cart into the barn to unhitch the horse. And Freddie comes running in and says that Bertha has been murdered. And Stephen goes in and finds Bertha on the floor, hacked to death in the kitchen of the house. And then gets in the cart and drives into the city to notify the police. And then the police start coming, and some other things happened, but the police started coming to the house, and about 20 of them showed up eventually.
So that's the basis of the story. Is a
right.
How old was Bertha at the time? She was
20. Well, she was born in 1871, so she's 22.
So she's 22. Right. She's murdered in her own home with an axe.
Right.
And it's less than a year from when the Bordens are murdered in Fall River in broad
almost,
daylight.
About 10 months almost to the day, right?
Yeah. So if I was a jury member waiting to go be a jury member on the Borden trial, I think that would affect me. I think I would think about that.
Well, it's at least one of the boxes, you know.
It really is. Oh, so there's somebody out there killing people. So it's more than just this.
So the police get there and there's nothing to go on. Well, they do a search. They find an axe in the yard. It's got blood on it. And it turns out Stephen had bought an axe not too much before that, I guess maybe in the springtime. And when he started chopping wood, part of the axe blade broke. So the axe wasn't suitable for chopping large pieces of wood anymore. So they kept it in the kitchen.
Okay, so this is very similar to the Borden case with the axes are not working when you buy one. That's weird.
So the axe would have been in the wood box next to the kitchen stove when the murder took place.
So it didn't come into the building with the murder weapon to kill her. It was a convenient weapon to kill her.
Right.
Now, one of the things you do in this case is you offer a really important comparison between the way the accused, Jose de Mello, was treated by the law enforcement and the way that Lizzie, the accused murderer, was also treated. There's some problems here with maybe class and gender. Would you care to explain those? Because I think that that's a fairly significant part of your book.
Let me take a step back. First of all, I find a little confusing because many of the participants in this book are Azorian, so they have Azorian names, and they don't fall off the eye, so to speak, when you look at them. I probably butcher them when I say them. But you used the name Jose de Mello, and I said Jose Carrero, so we have to take a step back. Jose Carrero was the person that was arrested for the murder. And that's the name that the other Azorians that were involved in the case at the time used for him. When the case went to the preliminary hearing, his defense team said, wait a minute, the man sitting here is not Jose Carrero, it's Jose de Mello. So you can't try him because the grand jury indicted Jose Carrero, and that's not him. But his name apparently was Jose de Mello. So after that point, he's always called Jose de Mello. So anybody listening to this, whether you hear Jose Carrero or Jose de Mello, it's the same person. So when I first looked at the case, of course, the case came to light because of the Borden murders. The police pretty quickly, and even the newspaper, almost all the newspapers dismissed it as being connected, except for the Boston Globe, which is interesting. They did want to keep it connected to the Borden case. Sort of the opposite of what they did in Lizzie Borden's instance. If we look at the Borden case, the differences between the two cases start right away. So the police show up at the Borden house about 11:30. By 11:45, 11:50, some of the policemen are starting to suspect Lizzie Borden. By the afternoon, she's pretty much a solid suspect. And in fact, that was a Thursday, and on Saturday, the mayor told her she was a suspect. So it didn't take long for her to be a suspect. Police did nothing in regard to the house, even though she was a suspect. So they searched the house. They found two axes and two hatchets, and they left them in the house and left.
And they left the family living in the house.
And they left the family living in the house, including Lizzie Borden.
In the crime scene.
Right. In the crime scene. So you've got Lizzie Borden in the house. You've got her uncle living in the house and her sister, all of whom could have had an interest in disposing of evidence. I'm not saying they did, but they could have.
And the neighbor and her friend, Alice Russell, stays the night.
And she's allowed to have anybody come in that she wants.
Right.
Her uncle, Hiram Harrington, comes at night with his wife. I can't remember her name now. One of Lizzie's friends shows up.
Mrs. Holmes. Mrs. Charles Holmes.
Oh, Mrs. Holmes, that was it. The next morning, they send a policeman to get the axes and hatchets. So they left them there overnight. other evidence was buried in the backyard.
Meanwhile, like the clothing, that
piece of hair that was chopped off of Abby, it was Abby Borden's head or wig. I'm not sure which it was, but
it was a switch of hair that was like a bun. Yeah.
And I think it was a bloody clothing, I think, was buried. Tuesday, the inquest starts. Lizzie Borden is picked up by the sheriff each morning, or a designated officer, taken home from the inquest. She testifies Tuesday and Wednesday. Both times is taken to and from the inquest by the police. Everybody else has to walk there. When she is finally arrested on Thursday, she's kept in the matron's cell, the matron's room in the police station, not in a cell. She's charged the next day and sent to Taunton Prison. There are rumors that was giving special treatment, but we don't know that. The matron of the woman's part of the prison did happen to be the mother of her schoolhood friend, so she may have gotten special privileges. When the preliminary hearing started, that lasted roughly, I'm going to say, 10 days. And she was, that was in Fall, back in Fall River, and she was allowed again to stay in the matron's cell, not in a cell.
But she had her food delivered, didn't she?
And she was allowed to have food delivered to the cell, to the matron's cell. And as I said, everybody was allowed to stay in the house. As you may recall, at the preliminary hearing, they had the state inspector there, and they also had Dr. Dolan, who was the medical examiner, and they were describing the blood spatters that they found in the two murder sites. And in the sitting room where Andrew Borden was killed, they had gone to the house, I believe it was a week after the murder, maybe it was 2 weeks after the murder, and they took measurements of the blood spatters in the sitting room. They had both been in the house on the day of the murders, but they hadn't taken any measurements. So when they went to the parlor door, the door between the parlor and the sitting room, they knew there were blood spots on there because they saw them on the day of the murders, and they'd been washed off when they went back to count them. And John Morse said that he assumed Emma washed them off. And I'm guessing she washed them off because people, as I said, they're allowing guests in the house, and they, you know, she's trying to get the blood spatter from the murder scene off. Now, I'm not saying Emma Borden did anything nefarious, but it just shows how evidence could be tampered with, even if it wasn't on purpose. Now, when the police go to the Manchester house, and by the way, there were reporters allowed in the Borden house, but they were all in there when the police were there. When the police show up at the Manchester house, they say everybody, now by now other people are there, Stephen Manchester, some of his son-in-law is there, and I think his other daughter was there by then. She was there eventually. And I think two of his sisters, I believe, were there by then. And one of the sisters had a nephew or niece with him. So there were four or five Manchester relatives there. And they were all told they had to get out of the house. Well, they might not have been told to get out right away, but the police were searching the house. And I think they had some questions like, you know, where do you keep this? Where do you keep that? But when the police were done searching and they were leaving the premises, they left two or three guards there to guard the house. And Stephen Manchester and his son were not allowed to stay in the house. They had to camp in the barn. Now, some people might say, well, why didn't he go down and stay with his sister and so on and so forth? Well, because he was a dairy farmer. He had to take care of the animals and he had to milk them. He said, well, I have to warm water to clean the milk cans each day to put fresh milk in for the next day. And they wouldn't let him heat water in the kitchen, let him go in. The next day after the
murder. Can I interrupt you? Do you think that the police learned from the previous murder that they needed to keep people out? Or do you think they just treated him differently for a reason?
It would be all speculation, but there are a few things. When the mayor was elected in, what was that? I forgot the name offhand.
Coughlin. Mayor Coughlin.
Oh, Mayor Coughlin, yeah. But Mayor Coughlin was elected in around 1890. Fall River had 80,000 people, but it still had essentially a town police department. And he put together a program to bring the police department into almost the 20th century for a city that size. When the Bordens were murdered, there wasn't a single detective on the squad or a single inspector. So he was putting that into effect during the time of the Borden murders. And by the time, 10 months later, of the Manchester murders, they had inspectors in place. They had police lieutenants in place and so on. It's a much more sophisticated department. It's possible they changed their ways during that time. You know, that was part of this thing. As far as learning from the Borden murders, I don't think it was so much that as far as keeping the people out of the house, although it might have been. I think it was more that the Bordens were upper class and the Manchesters weren't. That I'm speculating. I don't know that.
No, that's what I was. That's the kind of the way it feels after you read what happens next.
Right. Next day, they allow all the reporters to come in and do all. There are a lot of sketches in the book. And most of those sketches were done the day after the murders. They allowed all the papers plus Boston Globe sent sketch artists to the. I take that back. I'll get that in a minute because it's interesting. They sent sketch artists. They couldn't put photographs in the papers yet. They'd use sketches. They could make a sketch of a photograph, but they couldn't put a photograph in the newspaper. So they all sketched the house, the inside of the house. Bertha supposedly laying in front of the stove. Well, obviously she was long gone. One thing I found there, I don't think I'd ever mentioned this to you, but when I was doing the Borden case, I got the impression that the Fall River News was supposed to be the, of the three papers, was supposed to be the elite paper. That's where you go to get the news. Well, it was interesting to find out that in 1893, the news did not put sketches in the newspaper. They had no sketches whatsoever in the entire newspaper. So the Globe had sketches, the Herald had sketches, the Herald had the best sketches, and the Boston Globe had sketches, but the news did not. But they let the newspaper, now the Manchesters can't go in the house, but the newspaper reporter can go in the
house. See, there you go again.
So Tuesday, I think it was Thursday, Stephen Manchester's had it, and he goes to a lawyer to try to get overturned, the order overturned it with the mayor, police chief had issued the order. Police chief wouldn't overturn it. And finally, I believe it was Friday morning, Stephen was finally able to go in the house.
So it's like 4 or 5 days. He's like prohibited.
Well, about 3 days. About 3 days
he couldn't. He has to sleep in the barn.
Yes, sleep in the barn.
With his horses.
Right.
And his kid. But the other treatment was that had to do with the treatment of the accused. So right. We already know that, like you said, Lizzie was carted back and forth. She was given permission to stay at home. She had a special place to stay in the Fall River Jail. She perhaps got special treatment in Taunton, food delivered. She got visitors. Her sister would come and visit her. Her minister would come and visit her. She could spend time with them. She wrote letters that the Historical Society has. She whiled away the time. She actually got to know the matron, and they actually played that egg game. Right. Reporters tried to interview her. She wasn't interested. Things were happening, but she was made comfortable. But was that the case with the accused in the Bertha Manchester case?
So the police search the house. They determine that through Stephen and W.W. Coolidge, which is his daughter's husband, I guess because I got the impression that Jenny, the other daughter, was so overwrought she couldn't do interviews. So her husband was handling them. And her husband reported to the police. There were two different reports. I think Stephen said $10 was missing and he said $7. Coolidge said $7, but money was missing, and also Bertha's watch was missing. So they've got nothing to go on. So what do they do today when they've got nothing to go on? They look at the usual suspects. What do they do in 1893? The usual suspects. So the usual suspects are the lower class of the community, and in that case, it's the Azorians. The police, of course, have contacts within the community, the Azorian community, when they're doing investigations, but they're also offset somewhat by the Azorians being very tight-lipped. They don't really trust the white community in Fall River. And so the police were aware of one man who often was used by new Azorians coming to Fall River to try to find a job. Apparently he was the LinkedIn of Fall River during the day. the Azorian LinkedIn anyway. And they went to him, and he did keep names. I mentioned Stephen Manchester only had. Stephen Manchester kept a record of the hands that came to the house that he hired, but he only put down their first names. So all he knew was that this guy's name was Manuel, and that was the name that he used, not his real name. But the man in Fall River knew the Jose Carrero was the person he had sent to the Manchester farm the first time. the newspapers didn't say that they found anybody else. I don't know if they looked for other, I'm assuming they looked for other names, but they concentrated on this Jose Carrero because he was the last person that had worked there. And they assumed, with nothing else to go on and with something taken, that very likely, and because the hand stayed overnight in the house, or, you know, actually resided in the house as long as they were milking the cows, that such a person would have knowledge perhaps of valuable, where valuables would be or money would be hidden or something like that. It did so happen that Stephen did used to keep large sums of money in the house, but by the time of the murders, he didn't do it anymore. I guess he kept it in the bank or elsewhere, but he didn't keep it in the house. They decide to look for this Jose Carrero. So they find relatives in Fall River of Carrero. One member of the Azorian community came to the police and said they couldn't find Carrero. And they one person from the community said that they had heard he had gone to Taunton, which is what, 20 or 30 miles away, I guess. So they called in the cousin. The police called in the cousin of Carrero and said, you've got until, I think they said tomorrow. They gave him a short length of time to find, go to Taunton, find Carrero, or they would imprison him, the cousin. Obviously illegal, but that's what they were able to do in those days. And Carrero goes to Taunton and finds him. Now, you can't go to Taunton and say, Jose, the police want you to come to Fall River because they think you murdered somebody. Because he wouldn't be in Taunton very long, and he certainly wouldn't be going to Fall River. So they tell him that someone's stolen a horse. Well, this is the story, at least. Someone's stolen a horse, and they want to question you about it because they think you may know something about it. So Carrero goes back to Fall River. They bring in an interpreter, and they immediately grill him. Of course, they don't say you can have counsel. They don't say you can have some sleep tonight. He gets there about, I think it was 8 or 9 o'clock at night, and they just kept him up all night and browbeat him. He actually came on a Saturday night. It was Sunday morning that they arrested him. And then, as I said, Monday he went to face the charges. And
did he confess during that browbeating?
So what happened was, an interesting sidelight is the police refused to give any information to the press. So, and they might have learned that from the Borden case. And they refused to give any, but of course the press is dying for information. So the reporters had, I guess they do this today, they had a habit of hanging out at the police station. So a reporter from the Herald, I believe it was there at midnight one night, and in comes Jose Carrero with one of the detectives handcuffed to him in a cart, a horse cart. And I believe that might have been the police chief as well. There were some other policemen there. And so the Herald reporter sees this. So he knows something's going on. And I guess they felt the need that they had to tell him what was going on and what had happened. But they made him vow to silence until they gave him permission to report the story. And amazingly enough, he did. They had actually browbeat him during this time. No lawyer allowed, just browbeat him. Don't know what they threatened him. I'm sure they told me he was going to be hanged. And he took them to where the watch was hidden. Oh, and I forgot to mention an important point. By the time that Carrero came in, and I don't know how they found this out, the police had found out that someone had bought a pair of shoes the morning of the Manchester murder, and he fit the general description of a young Azorian. The shoe store owner and the witness of the purchase, who was Azorian, were brought in that night, the night that Carrero came in, and they identified him as the person that bought the shoes. And he had paid for the shoes with a trade dollar and a plugged half dollar. And those matched coins that Bertha Manchester owned. So it was pretty much a death sentence. So I guess that's why they kept browbeating him.
So he didn't have a lawyer present when he was interrogated.
No, never had a lawyer at all until the court appointed one after he was arrested.
Okay back then? There's no Miranda law.
Miranda law was, I think, 1960s, yeah. 70s.
But was it common, do you think? I mean, Lizzie immediately.
As far as I know, the police had a lot of latitude. And needless to say, no cameras, no microphones. So,
Lizzie's family hired a lawyer right away.
But she had one the same day. Well, of course, the family already had a lawyer. So, that was the other thing. The police never, early afternoon of the day of the murder, the police never questioned her, although they did question her on the stand at the inquest. District attorney did question her on the stand at the inquest.
So it feels like it's like a lot of railroading, even though he may in fact have done the crime, they're railroading him into a confession because they're keeping him up all night and they're not allowing him to, you know, to eat or drink or whatever until they get what they want to know. And then they're lying to his family in order to bring him in. And so they're betraying their own him as their family, but not knowing that they're betraying him. So they're creating this terrible situation where they're lying and stuff. And even the aftermath where the mayor and the city alderman's decision to not pay a reward for the arrest of the murderer, the city passed the order that the mayor proposed to give a reward from the city, whoever killed Bertha. But then when it came time to claiming it, there was this big excuse given while nobody could get it because the people who were asking for it were from the Azorian community, right?
Well, one of the ones that asked for it was the relative that was forced to bring Carrero in. So clearly he had something to do with, you know, solving the case. There was a law at the time that the city could not issue a reward more than $500. It was the limit. Although that would be many thousands today.
Right.
The mayor called a special session of the city council and he said, I'd gladly, you know, use some fancy phrase. I'd gladly, you know, give half the real estate of the city if we could find the murderer, you know, that kind of statement, but I'm limited to $500. So I've written out a reward proposal. And and they were in his office. He called me into his office. And I would like you to sign this authorization for this proposal. So they signed it. And the newspapers report, the town council, town alderman rather, signed an authorization for a $500 reward for anyone leading to the identity and capture of the, however it was worded, of the suspect in the case. I believe it was after the preliminary hearing, the uncle, who was the relative that brought him in, filed for the reward. There was a newspaper article that said, trust us, the town is going to find some way not to pay this. And not long after, the city refused to pay because the mayor had never signed the reward authorization. But the mayor is the one that wrote the reward authorization and asked the councilman to sign it. So the mayor had his cake and ate it. In other words, he had the reward printed in the paper, or the newspapers printed in the paper. So people were looking for the suspect to get the reward, but they knew they'd never have to pay the money. So then the uncle dies, and his wife now files for it, another Portuguese that applied for it, and they didn't get it either for the same reason.
Same reason. Yeah. So do you think if they hadn't been Portuguese that had found the guy and turned him in, they would have gotten their $500?
Well, not according to that rule, because he didn't sign it. So I don't know.
Yeah, well, that's just ripping off the public.
Of course, when Jose Carrero is put in jail, he's not put in the matron's room. He's given the typical cell in the room. Of course, once he went to prison, he got the same treatment as everybody else. But he certainly did not get the treatment Lizzie Borden did. Now, the cases aren't entirely parallel, but they're not entirely not parallel either. And certainly the treatment should have been much closer.
Wasn't there a moment when he wanted someone to come visit him and they said, you have to speak English? And he didn't speak English. And so he couldn't have a visitor because the police couldn't listen to their conversation?
Yeah, there were two reports about that in the newspaper that I found. I believe it was the day after he was arrested. Some members of the community brought him clothes and food and they wouldn't allow him in to give him the food and clothes. But now Lizzie Borden could get those kinds of things.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. It's just so obviously wrong.
That's just a matter of humanity. I mean, they could have checked the food and the clothes to make sure there's nothing in them. And then the second one was the one you're referencing. A member of the community came in to talk to him. And of course he was going to speak Portuguese because that's what they spoke. And the police would not allow them to speak Portuguese because they couldn't hear what they're talking about. And then, this was put in the newspaper that the police got some flack about that. And the spokesman for the police department, which was, I believe by then it was Harrington, who was by then a captain, He had been a patrolman during the days of the Borden case. He said, anybody can come in to see Jose as long as he has an interest in the case, meaning like if he had a lawyer or something like that. Doesn't mean an interest like, how are you doing? Are you feeling okay? He meant, you know, he had to have some legal connection to the case. He didn't have a lawyer, so nobody came to see him.
Were you ever able to track down Jose de Mello once he returned to the Azores? Because the end of the story is he gets out of jail, gets by petition of the local, started by the local Azorean Portuguese community. In Massachusetts, there's a pardon committee and there's also a governor's council, which is appointed by the governor, and they make these decisions of clemency. And so petitions went through and it was political. We don't need to get discuss that because I want people to read the book. We don't have to tell them everything. But he ends up getting out of jail after many years.
20 years. Yeah.
20 years. And deported immediately. And he goes back to the Azores. So were you ever able to track him down when he went back? And do you think any records exist in a consulate office anywhere? Or, I mean, you and I don't speak Portuguese or read Portuguese. So Is that the problem? Or what do you think?
I don't think there's any more information available that would be useful to the crime. Now, you might say, well, it'd be interesting to know, did he get married, have kids, something like that? But that wouldn't have anything to do with the crime that he committed. Part of the deal was he had to immediately go back to the Azores. It was sort of funny. There was a ship sailing from Boston on, I think, February 1st of 1914. They let him out of the prison with a prison escort. They literally had to run to the dock to get on the boat before it sailed. They were so afraid he might, you know, go into the crowd. I'm thinking, like, if I was Jose de Mello, I would have been running for the boat. I don't want to stay in the United States any longer than I have. But part of the deal was he had to leave right away, and he had to confirm that he was back in the Azores. And it took us almost 6 months, but a letter came from him to his lawyer that he had successfully gotten back in the Azores, and he was doing fine. And that's the last record.
He's a common last name in Portuguese community. So yeah. It'd be really hard to track it down.
As you see, there are no Fall River records available for the murder. So I don't know if there's any Azorean records, even if there were some. So,
well, there's no records in Fall River because way back when the police department was moving from one building to the other and they like threw everything away. And I heard from the Historical Society stories of them having to do some dumpster diving for some stuff because the police department threw away mug shots and they threw away arrest records and they threw away everything before a certain time. And they just were like getting rid of stuff. They didn't digitize it. They just threw it away. And some of the stuff that ended up in the Historical Societies because they went and they physically fished it. So there's nothing on Bertha, a short story. One time, my sister and I and our friend Harry Widows, we went to Oak Grove particularly to see Bertha Manchester's grave because she's buried there with her father. And we walked in and said, could you tell us where Bertha Manchester's grave is? And he said, oh, somebody's here for Bertha. I'm so excited. Nobody comes here for Bertha. Everybody comes here for Lizzie. I would gladly take you there myself. He was so excited because he's like, nobody cares about poor Bertha. She's a single person with a name like Bertha who was murdered. The guy was caught. The guy was deported. The story's over. It was an immigrant. You know, and in the Borden case, they immediately started thinking Portuguese, right? They thought Portuguese farmhand. And they're going over the river to try to find the Portuguese farmhand, which there wasn't one in the Borden employ. But that's the first thing they think of all the time is the Portuguese farmhand. You're very particular and in your writing, and you really never stray far from the truth. You did that in all three of your books. In other words, other people do. You don't. So other people have written fiction about Lizzie, and they've written what they call nonfiction about Lizzie, and it's could be put in the fiction section after you read it. Do you think that since this is the first book on the Manchester case, do you think it might inspire some fiction or theater or films? I mean, do you think that there's enough there to make it interesting for other people to take it and then run with it?
I actually think you could take the story as it is without having to fictionalize it. You know, the one that based on a true story type thing.
Mm-hmm.
Because you have the irascible old man who was a whaler. You know, you can always tie that in somehow. And every time he would get up to talk on the stand, he'd talk about, he'd have a whaling metaphor to talk about. You know, it's blowing like the wind along Cape Horn, you know, those kinds of things. He was a whaler for the rest of his life, apparently. You have the, you know, the mother that dies, not when Bertha was young, but that dies in childbirth of a subsequent child. You have the second wife comes in, everything's falling apart. You have the murder itself. You have the looking for the suspect. You have the Portuguese tie-in, Portuguese community tie-in to the case. And you have the treatment of the prisoner issue. And you also have the subsequent story of the Portuguese getting together to get him out of prison later on. So you have elements of a story there. It could be fictionalized as well, but I don't think you even have to. The problem with the Borden murder is if you're going to put a show on about the Borden murder, you have to fictionalize a lot because you don't know the details. You know, that's why the Borden case is so interesting, because we don't know the details. So all the Borden stories turn into speculation.
Right. And this one's considered solved because right. He arrested someone and sent them to prison.
Right.
Is there any question whether he didn't do it?
No. No, one thing that was very interesting is how the Portuguese stuck together on this. Even from the moment he was arrested, they sent the consul from Boston, whose name was...
the consulate, yes, the consulate, the Portuguese consulate, yes.
The Portuguese consulate names escaping me at the moment.
Well, he had a really long name, as I remember.
A real long name. So, but anyway, he comes to Boston, he comes from Boston to Fall River, and he gets off the train, and he says, "I'm here to make sure that the accused gets a fair trial. I'm not here for any other reason. I just want to make sure he's treated fairly." So they do allow him to go see Jose. Comes back later, I think it was at the time of the preliminary hearing, and he interviews Jose again, and Jose confesses to the crime and gives him all the details of the crime and claims that Stephen Manchester owed him money. And he went back to get the money. He needed the money. He went back to get the money from Stephen Manchester. He got in an argument with Bertha, and Bertha attacked him with the axe. He wrestled the axe away, and that's why she got, you know, because they were scuffling, that's why she got killed. Of course, it didn't make any sense because he ransacked the house. The reason I know that is because the consul then goes to the newspaper and tells him that whole story. Mm-hmm. So that whole story's in the newspaper. And why he would have done that, I don't know. But that's
well, it kind of says self-defense in a kind of a weird way. Like, I've come here to do a crime, but I didn't mean to kill her, you know, and so have mercy on me in a way.
Well, that's what he told the judge. Have mercy on me, but it didn't work. He got life. But of course,
hard labor life.
What? Yeah, hard labor. And hard labor in those days was hard labor. If you do think that he went there to steal money, which I do. Whether he thought he was owed the money or not, he was going to take it from the house. The murder resulted from a felonious act. So,
right. No, that's true.
So today, if it happened, he would still be charged with murder.
Right. No, he killed her. I mean, it's not unsolved crime.
Now, I do not believe he went there and expected any violence at all.
Right. So now you've got this thing where the murder happens in May.
Right.
May 30th, 1893, you've got, wasn't it the next day they were seating the jury or they were selecting the jury or they were going through selection?
No, May 30th was a Tuesday, so they selected the jury the following Monday.
So,
you're talking about the Borden jury.
Yeah, so the Borden jury goes into sequestration during the 13 days of the trial and is not allowed to read the newspaper or talk to anybody about anything.
Well, when they walked into court on Monday, I think it was the 5th of June, they were sequestered from that point. In other words, the 12 people were selected that day and never left.
All right. So that's it.
They couldn't have any newspapers, any visitors, nothing.
So they didn't know what was going on. They just knew that this woman was attacked by an axe and was killed.
Right.
So they go into
deliberations. That there was an arrest.
They go into deliberations for 10 minutes.
Right.
And they sit around and play tic-tac-toe for the rest of the 45, 50 minutes.
Right.
And come out in an hour and say not guilty.
Right.
Now, they never, while they were very intent on staying together as a team and had memorial dinners every year with each other, and it was always in the newspaper when one of them died, and it was like, oh, another Borden jury member has passed away. And they never talked about their deliberations. They never revealed their thinking on the case. They didn't, like today, they'd write a book, right? If you were on the Borden trial in today, you would be it would be a bestseller because you would be the jury, you'd be in the room, you'd hear the evidence, and you'd say why you thought the way you did and why everybody else thought the way they did. So is it slightly kind of in a sliver possible that it figured into their decision of her innocence because they knew there had been another axe murder, but they didn't know the outcome of it during the trial?
The way I would look at it is if the jury had heard overwhelming evidence of Lizzie Borden's guilt, I think they would have convicted her.
Mm-hmm.
But remember that a lot of the evidence wasn't allowed at trial. The prosecutor right. Purchase was not allowed at trial. They could not read Lizzie Borden's inquest testimony at trial.
Mm-hmm.
So the jury only heard a partial case. And I recall two jurors that talked a little bit to newspapers afterwards. And they seemed to indicate that the minute they walked out of the courtroom to deliberate, they already knew it was going to be not guilty. So
that means they decided ahead of time.
Yeah. Now, if it were me, I would have put the axe murderer on the loose in Fall River still in an open checkbox, in coming to a not guilty verdict. I would think it was at least considered. They never talked about it, but I would think it was at least considered. It might not even be considered by conversation, but each individual juror might have thought about it.
Yeah, and you're in the book. One of the things that you spend a lot of time doing, I recall, is creating really good illustrations and maps so that people know exactly where you're talking about and where things are in relation to other things. Now, the house that is the farmhouse that was the Manchester farm, that's not there anymore, but the street is there, but it's now Meridian Street, and it's been changed so much that there's no way that you can find the actual location, unlike, you know, the Borden house, which right. is still there. And it can be challenging to really read a book without illustrations, like to get a sense of place. And you do rely on newspaper sketches, which I wanted to talk to you about. How would you rate the various newspaper sketch artists of the period? Because I always thought the Boston Globe had the very best.
The Boston Globe was, it was the big city newspaper. But the next best one, as I mentioned, was the Herald. And the Globe was also good. I'm just looking at the book now, and Fall River Globe had a sketch artist named Leary. Now, I don't know, though, if they were in cahoots with the Boston Globe and Leary's from the Boston Globe or not, but their sketch artist was good. The Herald guy also signed his work, and his name was Braley, and they were very good.
You've got this one picture of poor Bertha, and it's such a line figure. She looks really dirty, and it's just an awful... Like, I could draw better than that. Which newspaper was that one from?
There are two sketches of Bertha that I could find. The one that I use in the book is she looks like a young girl. I'm assuming they came from photographs, but I don't know. The second one is extremely unflattering. I decided not to use it because I don't know if it was real or they just sketched somebody they thought looked like Bertha or not. But I really wanted to get a picture of her. The reason I contacted the 40 people through Ancestry was to make Bertha a real person. I really wanted a picture of her, not just some printing a book about a lady that was killed or a young girl that was killed, but a person. And then that's what gets lost in all of these murder cases. The victim is the last thing you think about. I mean, like, consider the Borden case. How many people talk about Andrew and Abby Borden? They talk about Lizzie Borden, the person that might have killed them.
Do you think that since you found this kind of treasure with this man on Ancestry, do you think that there's more treasures to be found?
I'm hopeful. I've sent the book to a couple of people that contacted me, and you know, I'm hoping that jars their memory a little bit. I was even looking for family lore. Now, family lore, I mean, my family's got lore that I found out wasn't true, and I'm sure the Manchester family lore sometimes isn't true. Some of the family lore I learned, I'm glad it's not true. But anyway, it would at least given some palpability to the case. And
some color to the story.
Right, yeah, right.
Yes, yeah, actual, because, you know, there's the Lizzie Borden wasn't anybody until the murder happened. So nobody knew who she was, really. And nobody knew who really Stephen Manchester was beforehand. And he wasn't a prominent anything. He was a dairy farmer. So, and Bertha was, you know, just this woman who didn't have a boyfriend and stayed and worked and did her thing. I mean, I thought it was touching. When I first started hearing about the case, I always thought, oh, that's Stephen Manchester. He's got to be a creep. And then reading your book, I came with a whole completely different conclusion about his character. There were parts of him that were rough and gruff and violent, and there were parts of him, though, that were tender and kind. So Bertha doesn't get to go with them because she has work to do on that day. And there's going to be a parade in Fall River because it's Memorial Day, Decoration Day. So before he goes home, he stops and buys her flowers.
And he's $1.50 of flowers. And to put perspective in that, he paid the farmhand $15 a month. So $1.50 worth of flowers was a pretty good sized purchase that he took home to his daughter.
What a sweetheart that is, because you, my daughter, stayed home and did all the work so I could go do my job. I want to give you something that is heartfelt, and I'll buy you this. And that is just like, it's a completely different thing. And the fact that you discovered all of that converted me into liking him so much more, and to completely eliminating him from my mind as some kind of ogre, which is somehow what I thought. And I don't know where it came from. And it may have come from just chitter chatter in Fall River kind of thing, because there has never been a book about it. And nobody's really investigated it through the newspapers, and nobody has done anything with it. It was just what people said.
He was a crusty old guy.
He was crusty, yes.
But he seemed very devoted to his, not the oldest son, but I'm not sure what happened there, but he seemed very devoted to the two daughters and the one son, Freddie, although he was not devoted to Alexander. But he was, he would buy the daughters things. He said he gave them, I think, he made a list of several things he'd give them over the years, you know, dollars and jewelry and things like that.
Yeah, so, I mean, I love that about the book. I love learning more about the person, and that book does this. And you also get to read some unpleasant things about Stephen, but let that be discovered by the reader. I won't tell what it is here, but I really like this book. And so what are you going to write about next? I know you're into true crime and historical aspects of true crime and other historical interests. And do you have any interest in a book about the Kennedy assassination now that there's this new book out by this guy who's changing his story, or the Lincoln assassination? I mean, is there anything else that makes you think you want to write a book?
The Kennedy one, are you talking about the bodyguard that wrote the
book? Yeah, the bodyguard, yeah.
So he's
the Secret Service guy, yeah.
He's 88 years old, and he's now decided to tell people that he found a bullet on Kennedy's... Kennedy's... Well, he put it in the gurney. He found it in the back seat of the limousine.
Yeah.
I'm thinking, like, did you think it was important before now? Or,
Well, no, it's a different story than what he told
then.
So he's changed his story. So I'm not putting anything to...
But no, he was an eyewitness. Whether the bullet aside, he was an eyewitness to the event. I don't have that luxury. I like the, let's call them the small murders, because I think, I don't like it that Bertha Manchester gets overlooked, but the Bordens are a big deal. You know, they're both families that they got people killed. You know, they're equal.
Right. Right.
And I would never have known about this story without the Borden murders. And think of how many other stories are out there like that. The limiting factor is finding it, and then is there any background material available that you can flesh it out?
Oh, I've got somebody for you to write about. I'll send it to you in an
email. Yeah, I'd like to.
I have a great idea about somebody who happened to have been like one of the earliest serial killers that nobody's heard of. Yeah.
So I'm interested in looking into that. I had considered writing a book about Tom Dula, who's known familiarly as Tom Dooley. You know, hang down your head, Tom Dooley.
Yeah.
But there have been at least two books written about the murders. There's no mystery in it. And the books are pretty well written, so I don't know that I'm going to tackle that. Although it was not too far away from here that it happened, so I would be able to get some source material. Also, I live in Raleigh, and the state archives are here, so a lot of the records from the trials that I think he had two trials are available there. Although they were all handwritten, and they're almost impossible to read.
Well, that sounds exciting. I'd read that.
But right now, as you know, if I tell somebody I wrote two books about the Bordens, they don't ask about what are the books about. They say, did Lizzie Borden do it?
So now
I'm writing a book about whether I think she did it or not. So.
Oh, cool. Good. I'm glad. Well, I really appreciate your time and thank you for the conversation. And the book, again, is called The Other Fall River Tragedy, The Murder of Bertha Manchester, and it is out now on Amazon in paperback and Kindle, and you could buy it online through the Fall River Historical Society as well and get a signed copy if you're interested at the same price that it's available on Amazon, and you'd be helping the society out by doing so. So,
by the way, why don't you tell them about the cover picture?
Oh, yeah. Okay. So the cover picture. So I guess I have to confess that I'm your book designer. So I design the book and I design the cover and you say yes or no to whatever it looks like. And I was really excited by this cover that I designed because it is a photograph from the day the murder happened on the road the murder happened. So there's this gentleman named Brown who used to ride around Fall River in the 1890s and early 1900s. And he would ride on his bicycle and he would take a camera and he would just snap photographs. And he has quite a collection at the Society. And he had two images of New Boston Road, the dirt road, the road that the Manchesters lived on the day, May 30th, 1893, that the murder happened. And so the cover is a picture of the exact day, not knowing what we're looking at, not knowing whose house that is in the picture, if it's the farm itself, there's no way to know. There's certainly not a lot of people in the picture. There's no people in the picture, but I colorized it a bit to make it look more real. And yeah, so it's a sign that a picture actually existed of that road that day.
And again, it's the only actual photograph we have other than Stephen Manchester in conjunction with the case.
Yeah, it's amazing to me. It was just like I saw it in a publication by the Historical Society. I said, can I use that? And they're like, oh, sure. Thank goodness. Well, thank you again, Bill. I really appreciate your time. And I hope to work with you again on a new book because I like reading what you write.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you for listening to the Lizzie Borden Podcast, episode 27. We've been talking to Bill Spencer about his latest book, The Other Fall River Tragedy, The Murder of Bertha Manchester. Find Richard Barron's Lizzie Borden Girl Detective Stories at Amazon.com and at LizzieBordenGirlDetective.com, where you can follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Listen to more Lizzie Borden podcasts on our website or on Podbean, Audible, Google Podcasts, Amazon Music, Spotify, and YouTube.